A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Helen.
And in this week's New Statesman podcast, we'll be charting Jeremy Corbyn's journey from 2.0 to 2.0. We'll have Donald Trump's golden shower. We'll have Julia in to discuss who her backbencher of the week is. And you ask us what is going on in Northern Ireland.
So, Stephen, do we really have to talk about urine?
I'd just like readers to know that we've actually had several takes of that joke, and I didn't find it funny the first time, and actually I can feel my heart beating slower in a bid to not have to survive that joke.
Okay, that's fine. I won't make you listen to that joke again, although I do have many others. But let's talk about Corbyn first in that case. So there was a briefing over the weekend that he was going to be like Trump, tying everything that we're going to talk about today together, because he was going to just face down the media, yeah, and call people out. He wasn't going to try and curry favour, and he was going to be populist. And then he went on the Today programme and I think, could have talked about the NHS crisis, given that that was on the front pages that morning. Could have talked about his speech later on the day about free movement, in which he said the Labour was not wedded to the principle of free movement. But he kind of just sort of decided to, which very Trumpily, spitball a little bit about his idea for a high pay cap, which by the end of the day resulted in a policy that I thought was not absurd, but was kind of, I think, certainly caught everybody slightly on the hop.
This might be me being hugely wrong because the entire world disagrees with me from kind of the left to the right. But actually, I think it's possible to overdo slightly this, oh, the Tories were on the back foot over the NHS, then Jeremy changed the subject, what a howler. The NHS is one of the few areas where Labour still has a lead in terms of what is more trusted to look after than the Conservatives. And if the NHS, as it is threatening to do at the moment, does properly keel over, people are going to notice, even if Jeremy Corbyn is on TV on a unicycle juggling fruit, right?
That would be awesome, though.
There's an extent to which it's only useful for the opposition if the NHS is in a mess, if it has fixed its problems elsewhere. And I think it can be very tempting when you're the opposition and it's hard to make news to cling on to whatever passing bit of driftwood you can find. So I'm not actually sold on the argument that people are making that it would have been better for him to just go, the NHS is in crisis. Partly because I think the mistake a lot of left-wing people make about fighting campaigns on the NHS is at any given time, most people aren't ill. And they just assume that the NHS, they're like, oh, I'm distantly aware that it's crowded and it's on the morning news and between the music and all of that kind of thing. But people kind of are optimistic and they sort of assume that when they get sick, obviously I'll be fine, right? And then if you're seriously sick, you're preoccupied with being sick. And once you've recovered, you don't want to think about what it was like to be horrendously ill. So actually the...
Yeah, I think that analysis might slightly miss the, say, 40, 50-something child of an elderly parent for whom they're not the one that's sick, right, but they're constantly dealing with NHS problems. Or, there's a sort of rubric, isn't there, that 80% of GP's time is taken up with 20% of chronic patients. So it is inevitably a small amount of people. What I thought was, two things I thought of Jeremy's 2.0 relaunch that I thought were really interesting. One, when YouGov asked the question about high pay cap of £1 million, right, which was not a figure that Jeremy Corbyn put on it at all, that policy still had 31% support. And actually quite a big don't know on it as well. So better than Labour's current poll rating, which was interesting to me. I did not think it would be that high. And the second thing was that by the end of the day, they started talking about putting anyone who bids for a public sector contract would have to, the top pay could only be whatever is 20 times multiple of the lowest pay, which was kind of sweet because it reminded me of, do you remember Ed Miliband? Do you remember, like, pre-distribution?
He strikes a distant chord.
And do you remember the fact that a lot of that was about the fact that they were going to get people who bid for public sector contracts, you know, to only be able to pay the living wage and stuff like that? It just made me kind of nostalgic because it's part of my thesis about Jeremy Corbyn slouching towards Milibandism being the kind of theme of Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of the Labour Party so far.
Well, it turns out that effectively the 2015 leadership election was actually a contest between Northern Miliband, female Miliband, woke Miliband and Liz Kendall. But this, I'm going to get boring and wonky here. The problem with pay caps is you have all of the political argument that you get for just increasing people's taxes, right? Blah, aspiration, oh blah, won't all the good footballers leave the Premier League? But at the end of it, if you win the argument, you've capped the pay, people aren't being paid anymore, and therefore you can't tax it. I'm not entirely clear why you'd want to do it when you've got to have the same blowback than you'd have if you went, I'm just going to tax...
70% tax on everything, a million, yeah.
Pay differentials, however, I think actually are a reasonable policy, particularly as far as public sector procurement is concerned. You know, as Jeremy pointed out, if you have a 20% ratio, you can still be paid 350 grand, provided you are paying your lowest paid staff a living wage, right? It's not an unreasonable policy ask. And in terms of the argument about the Overton window, which is not something I personally am quite sceptical of, yeah, I don't think that is how political change actually happens, but in terms of that idea, it does at least create a space where if someone starts by going, I'm for pay caps, it does at least allow someone to seem reasonable purely by going, well, actually, I think maybe we should just have like a land tax.
Yeah, I thought that. I thought, you know, actually, if there's any point to what people wanted from Jeremy Corbyn, it was that he wasn't going to be kind of bound by how's this going to play in Nuneaton, right? They wanted him to kind of espouse some things that were genuinely radical that hadn't been said for years in British political... I mean, you know, I think something that George is always fond of quoting is the fact that, you know, under Margaret Thatcher, we had a top tax rate that was higher than it was now. If you talk about tax, where the narrowness of the debate is kind of slightly astonishing. Do you think it will work? That's my fundamental question about Corbyn 2.0. Is there a left-wing populism to be had?
Well, I mean, I don't know, to be honest. So on the one hand, you have got this problem that throughout Europe, and actually to a lesser extent in the United States, obviously... Their nativist did win, but he only won because of their weird electoral system. But throughout Europe, the nativist right is eating into the left's vote share. It means that when the left is in power, it's in power in very weak coalitions, or mostly it's not in power at all. So you've clearly got to do something about this hostility towards immigration, this culture war that's going on. What Jeremy is trying to do is he's trying to find a way of matching that without necessarily bending the knee to anti-immigration, nationalist or atavist sentiment. So kind of hopefully it does work because it's sort of the last thing left now, isn't it? And yeah, because the idea is basically the theory runs that the right is succeeding by saying, making left-wing noises and then doing and coupling that with some very right-wing things. And so maybe you can win by having some right-wing noises and doing some left-wing things. I think the difficulty is, say what you like about Nigel Farage, and I have many unflattering adjectives for him, he does sort of successfully embody that political marriage. Jeremy looks so uncomfortable whenever, so kind of, the immigration stuff, which let's get onto in a bit as well, right? I'm not really sold on the idea that the electoral case for that is as strong as many people think it is. But the one case I know definitely doesn't exist is the Labour position of, we kind of think you don't like immigration, so we've decided to meet you halfway on this, but we're going to look really uncomfortable doing so.
Well, that's Miliband, isn't it? I mean, this is what I mean about it. It's controls on immigration as a mug, but obviously an uneasy leader trying to kind of talk about immigration and in a way that you can tell that he's worried that he comes off as being kind of nativist.
Yeah, and I also think one of the... I mean, there are lots of reasons why the left in old Europe has been more and more discomforted by immigration issues. But my instinct is one of the problems is that crime has fallen throughout the developed world. And what you could do if you were on the left, if you say that there's a political palate and one of the tastes is sort of rage, is that the kind of left-wing offer for rage was, we're going to be really tough on crime. Because you actually can
be... Tough on the causes of crime.
But this is the thing, you can reduce crime in ways which are genuinely left-wing, right? You can just say, oh, isn't it awful? This shouldn't happen. I completely agree. And you can be entirely sincere about it. And then you do things which are actually compatible with left-wing values that actually reduce crime. The difficulty with immigration, right, isn't, I get how you can go, oh, there's a progressive case, or, oh, we're not wedded to the principle of free movement, or any of that noise, right? But it's quite difficult to work out how you actually keep those promises in a way which doesn't shred your values and harm the economy. And I think that in some ways, it's back in that trap of, oh, are you Holland or are you Miliband, right? Do you just lose, or do you win on this contradictory platform that you can't govern from? You get into office, your popularity collapses, and the right wins. Whatever happens.
Although that said, did you see the very exciting polling that's come out of France showing Macron is not that far behind Le Pen and Fillon in first round intentions, and if he gets through to the second round against Le Pen, he would win very comprehensively. I'm going to put all my eggs in the Macron basket in 2017 purely because it would be more interesting.
I mean, yeah, obviously Macron is hunky and Blairite, much like myself, but I'm just paused to allow for laughter.
I didn't say anything. I said
but,
nothing.
He's to the right of where Holland ran, right? He may end up governing into a place fairly similar to where Holland ended up. But in any case, if you'd said to someone who had truly bought into François Holland, and now I think about it, was there anyone who really did? He was sort of the, oh God, DSK's exploded, let's jump on this bandwagon so we can get through the election and defeat the right. I don't think if you said to any of those people at the end, this pretty boy centrist who none of you have heard of yet is going to be president, they'd go, oh goody.
Yeah.
It's a bit like whatever
happens
in France.
That is the lesson of 2016, is that you will take the least worst option.
I mean, a lot of the time people have just been taking the worst option.
Yeah, that's what I mean. That you don't, you know, this is surely the lesson is you can't hang around for the perfect candidate. Sometimes you just have to vote against someone.
Yeah, but I just think then if the offer you were making to Jeremy Corbyn was you'll be prime minister for 5 years, you'll become a national laughingstock, your party will disintegrate, and in the end, like, Tony Blair will set up a new party and beat you. That's not really, I don't think he would say, oh goody, where do I sign? And that is obviously all comparisons across countries are mostly odious, and that is a particularly bad one, but just...
Yeah, let's quickly talk about Donald Trump and the leaks that have been come out. Mother Jones reported just before the election that there was a file that was being passed around intelligence agencies. It had gone to John McCain, Harry Reid in the Senate had also seen it, which was alleging that the Russians had got a very big dossier of allegations against Trump that they were kind of using essentially as compromat. They were using this to blackmail him. No one had actually kind of reported the specific allegations of that, but we do know that it probably informed the letter that Harry Reid wrote making accusations that, you know, Putin and Russia specifically wanted Trump to win and had done, you know, deliberate hacks around that. The thing that obviously made Twitter explode is the fact that BuzzFeed published the whole document, which comes from an ex-MI6 intelligent agent, which was initially prepared as opposition research on Trump by his Republican opponents and then funded a bit by some Democrats as well. And they've spoken to various people in Russia. The bit that's kind of everybody can't get over because it's kind of so-called blimey is this allegation that Trump went to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Moscow, found the bed that President and Michelle Obama had slept in, and because he hates them, he'd hired prostitutes to do a urination show, that's how I decided to describe this, in order to sort of defile it. Which, let's be honest, is great punning material. I mean, is there going to be a live stream of his press conference, water sports gate? It was all
okay,
there.
Okay, we don't need any more.
Okay, I'll leave it there. But my question with it is, I'm really worried that actually the publishing the dossier will backfire, because Trump's response to it has just been to go, this is fake news, it's a witch hunt. Actually, he literally said the words, it's like Nazi Germany. A lot of urination there, clearly. And I worry that it's kind of going to let him, even though I think there are interesting questions about his relationship with Russia, by bundling that all together into a big package of allegations in one dossier, I worry it's going to allow him actually, weirdly, less scrutiny.
So I'm not sure about that for a couple of reasons. So obviously a large chunk of the dossier is very similar to Curveball, the Iraqi informant who underpinned a lot of the case for going to war with Iraq, and most of that testimony turned out to be fairly bogus. And it does feel like there are lots of holes in this leak. We know then the Russians wanted to target the Democrats. They wanted Trump to win. As I've said before, because the margin was so small, basically everything from Hillary's own unpopularity to Comey's letter to the way that the leaks were covered, you know, the hacking
Comey's
of...
Comey's lack of letter about this, right? So if the FBI director, James Comey, writes a letter saying, I'm reopening the investigation into Hillary Clinton because I've got these extra emails from Anthony Weiner, and then closes it again, he could very much have written a letter that said, I'm opening an investigation into these allegations about Donald Trump, but didn't.
Yeah. So because of that, basically everything everything matters because everything could have changed the outcome. And that goes for campaign errors in the Clinton machine as well, right? But Hillary's private email server and the emails that were hacked by the Russians were completely unrelated. And one of the things I and a lot of people got wrong about the election was that we went, oh, no one really understands this email scandal, therefore it won't matter. It turned out that because people didn't really understand what the email scandal involved, it meant that whenever they heard hacking in emails, they thought it was all part of one big story instead of two entirely unrelated stories. So actually, lots of noise about Russia probably doesn't harm Trump's American opponents all that much. And in terms of the bigger ongoing fight, which is whether or not Rex Tillerson, his preferred choice for Secretary of State, is confirmed, anything which keeps the idea that he is Russia's buddy on the agenda means it is slightly harder for Tillerson to get confirmed. It emboldens and gives cover to Republican Russia hawks to vote with the Democrats against Rex Tillerson.
This is because Rex Tillerson got a medal from Vladimir
Putin. And I think one of the stages of Trump denial, right, is there is a certain type of liberal or a certain type of left-winger who hasn't, I think, quite absorbed what a good outcome from the Trump presidency actually looks like. So, you know, you see it when someone says, oh God, I hope they impeach him and we get Pence, and someone goes, but Pence is just as bad for women, the right to choose, gay people, ethnic minorities in America, all of which is true, but Pence won't accidentally cause a nuclear exchange with China because he doesn't have the disposition to be president, which is a real live risk with Trump. So even though whoever Trump's Secretary of State is will be horrendously right-wing, there are options which aren't Tillerson, who are probably better for global security. This is the thing, is that there is quite a big difference between a disaster that is a disaster for America and a disaster for any hope for a global deal to tackle climate change than there is for a disaster which ends with nuclear winter. That's my cheery thought for the day.
Thank you for that. And now for a section we like to call Backbencher of the Week, because it's about a backbencher of the week.
We were up all week coming up with this.
Julia Rampin, our Staggers editor, has joined us. And in classic New Statesman podcast, slightly ham-fisted style, technically your pick is not a backbencher.
Yeah, and I felt a bit rude because I emailed her office today just to say, has she been doing anything of note that I missed? And I was like, you know, as a backbencher and also leader of your own party. But
so don't leave us in suspense anymore. Who have you picked?
Caroline Lucas. And the reason is, well, we've only had a few days of the new season anyway, so there hasn't been much time for other backbenchers to let loose. But Caroline has written a piece for the Staggers about free movement. We've seen a lot of reaction to it, and I think it's very timely because it comes the day after Jeremy Corbyn seemed to fumble over what he actually thought. And she's basically written a defence of free movement. The reasons I think it's interesting is, A, it argues that there are economic benefits to free movement, which is actually a long-standing argument we've kind of forgotten for the last 6 months. And the other part of it is that it's actually not a neoliberal economic argument that she's making. It's more about people filling jobs that otherwise wouldn't be filled, and the idea that the pressures on low wages can be dealt with using other policies like raising the minimum wage.
Now, Stephen, you wrote, I think, a Facebook note on your Facebook page, which people obviously can sign up, saying you were worried that Labour's poll ratings flaw was not, there was no flaw, there was only a kind of plunging lift. And one of your reasons for this was saying that at the last election in 2015, Natalie Bennett was Green leader. Now there are two leaders of the Green Party, one of whom is Caroline Lucas, and you find her quite impressive.
So obviously Labour's poll rating is bad by sort of any means. We've had an immigration policy for Labour which basically feels like an invitation to every party out there to come and take their votes. And during the last election, in Labour's post-mortem, one thing which was basically clear is Natalie Bennett would go on TV and the Green vote would go down. She was a net gain to the Labour campaign. During the short campaign, Tim Farron, Caroline Lucas, Jonathan Bartley, her co-leader, will all be given a media platform that they just don't get outside of election time. It feels to me highly unlikely that Caroline Lucas being on TV more will be bad for the Green Party. In fact, it feels very likely to me that it will be good for the Green Party.
So here's a question that I think people ask me sometimes now, which is kind of, given Corbyn's stances, where is left for the Green Party to go? I mean, you've mentioned migration. The Greens have a kind of pretty unequivocally pro-migration per se, not just mealy-mouthed pro-free movement. What are other things that are kind of distinctive Green Party policies?
I guess one that Caroline was putting forward in this argument is the idea of an economic policy that in some ways has overlaps with Labour, but I guess the Green Party as a small party is able to perhaps make more purist arguments. So, for example, she's very interested in ideas of basic income and raising the minimum wage quite substantially to a true living wage. And I think she does have a point that one thing that surprises people is the lowest paid in the country have actually seen their wages rise, and that is exactly because of government policy increasing the minimum wage. The Greens are also very radical on the idea of the housing market. I remember their manifesto in 2015 had some quite surprisingly extreme views, I suppose, if you're a mainstream economist on what you would do. They speak very much to renters as well, I think more than the Labour Party does.
They're interesting. They've got some interesting kind of splits emerging within them, though, on sex work and gender and things like that, because they have got a pretty, I'm trying to think of a non-pejorative way to say this, a pretty Tumblr-y wing, shall we say? You know, people, the kind of person who would use the word SWERF, unironically, which is, for those of you who don't know, sex worker, exclusionary radical feminist. Whereas, traditionally, Caroline Lucas has been a supporter of the Nordic model, the idea that you criminalise sex buyers, but not the people who sell sex. But I think there's a really interesting question for the Green Party about, everyone assumed that kind of Corbyn had eaten their lunch, the Labour Party was now going to move into a space that where the Green Party was. But it kind of ignores the fact that actually there is space to the left of Labour and also to be kind of interestingly radical in different ways.
Well, I think the problem for Labour is they're the only party in the United Kingdom which has to win in all of the, apart from Northern Ireland, where they don't compete, they have to win in every kingdom of the United Kingdom, right? The Greens only need to win in places like Brighton or certain bits of Lambeth or Hackney, right? They are not aiming to be a genuinely national force, and whichever one of the Bristol constituencies they're strong in, and I always get them confused.
I think West, but I don't know. I think that might be
half of them have got West in the title in, though, because their boundary review is maddening. And it's particularly irritating because Bristol has so many lovelily named places. You know, you could have Bristol, Montpellier, you could have...
All right, stop
Bristol,
sucking up to Bristol.
But, you know, I'm just saying.
Okay, but is there anything that Caroline's doing this year that all coming up soon that we should be watching out for, Julia?
Well, the other interesting thing is her views on defence, because the Green Party hasn't really had much of a defence policy at all. And Caroline did another op-ed for us just before Christmas that was a bit more controversial with our readers, perhaps. But it's actually very interesting because it was just saying what a lot of Labour people would be saying, that she thought that there should be considerations of some kinds of humanitarian supplies to Syria. But that in itself is quite a big step for the Green Party. So I think on the one hand, you're seeing a fringe party perhaps mature and, as Stephen says, become a more credible voice on TV, but on the other hand, even that article did divide the opinion on it.
Well, thank you very much. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Well, we'll have a real backbencher, because we're gonna, luckily, what can an angry Green really do to us? They're lovely people, they won't be mean. But thank you, Julia, for joining us.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
And now it's time for a little section we like to call...
You Ask Us! People like that. I had a tweet by someone who said that they liked that.
Yeah, I'm speaking for the silent majority.
Okay. This week, lots of questions, actually. A surprising number of questions, which I was pleased about. People have really been reading on the website, too, our pieces about Northern Ireland and what's happened there. So, the Deputy First Minister, Martin McGuinness, has resigned. And under the terms of the power-sharing agreement, that means if Sinn Féin don't appoint another Deputy First Minister within 7 days, Arlene Foster of the DUP has to resign as well, triggering an election mere months after the last one.
No, so she has resigned because of how the power sharing works.
Yeah.
He resigns, she resigns, right? Yeah. There's parity of esteem that is notionally the same job. One of the issues, which I imagine we will get into in this segment, is that parity of esteem sometimes doesn't necessarily exist in reality. There are lots of people in Sinn Féin who feel that under her predecessor, that parity of esteem has not really been there. But they both are automatically, one of them resigns, the other one resigns, unless there is a replacement.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Unless they put someone else up, then by default, like, it's over, right? And they have to call an election. It's one of those things where you think, wow, this is a really old-fashioned scandal, right? It's quite hard to grasp. It's called Cash for Ash, right? So it's about renewable energy, and basically they set the maximum amount that anyone could claim way too high, so loads of people trousers and stuff.
So the idea of the Renewable Heat Initiative was it was meant to encourage you to switch from non-renewable sources of energy. There are a couple of problems. The first is there was no cap to how much energy you could claim back. The second is there was no requirement for this energy to be replacement energy usage. So let's take this lovely catacomb that we are recording in. Obviously, it has some heating now.
So you could just turn all the heaters on full blast, and as long as we were being powered by like a dam or a wind turbine, it could rain money.
You could rain money. But let's say, for example, that you've got a cold basement which you just store paper in, so you don't have the heating on. It is not a saving in terms of energy consumption for you to install a new renewable energy boiler and turn it on 365 days a year. But under the Renewable Heat Initiative, or Cash for Ash, you were paid to do this, right? There were businesses which were planning to install, and they're in some businesses which have installed heaters in storage rooms, heaters in rooms which have no people in, have no plans to have you in order to get the money. So as well as it costing a phenomenal amount of money, right, it will cost about £1 billion over 20 years. Having to find £1 billion over those 20 years is a big, big deal. And the reason why it has become politically alive is, one, that it appears that ministers realised there was a problem and tried to sit on it for a long time. Secondly, then when Arlene Foster, now the First Minister, was the minister in charge of the department responsible for the scheme when it was birthed, she and, until relatively recently, Sinn Féin have both been saying, no, we don't want a full-blooded inquiry. The case against it isn't as... You might go, oh, come on, you've spent £1 billion through incompetence. How do you not want an inquiry? A proper sort of full-fledged inquiry, as opposed to an investigation, takes years... also costs a lot of money. So there's an argument for just having a quick investigation, which is what they did with Robinson when he was involved in Irisgate, which involved payments to someone who's now his ex-wife. He was completely exonerated, but he crucially stepped aside as First Minister. Arlene Foster has not. This is one of the things which is causing a lot of anger. She's said that her critics are acting out of misogyny, which there unquestionably is in Northern Irish politics, as there is worldwide. However, the reason why people are angry is that...
she spent all the money.
She spent a lot of money.
What's going to happen, though? This is my kind of... this is the you ask us element of this. So we're expecting another election. People traditionally, I think, political researchers, you know, people don't like being asked the same question twice, right? They don't like really frequent elections because they kind of feel like, come on, I've got stuff to do. What do you anticipate any change in how that works over there?
There are a couple of fun things to bear in mind. So firstly, under the Northern Irish system, they have mandatory power sharing, which means... the first and the second party get to pick the first and the deputy minister, respectively, and then they get to pick from the portfolios going on down. And then the ministerial posts are decided by the D'Hondt system. So the third, the fourth, they also get to pick. But the only ones which have to go into government together are the first and the second. And if they don't, then you don't get a government. Direct rule from Westminster comes back in. So,
but also to add to the complication about this is the fact that there is as yet no answer on freedom of movement and the single market, and the fact that there is a land border with the Republic.
A land border with the Republic,
and
which is...
it's written into the Good Friday Agreement, I think, as well, isn't it, to the human membership of the European Court of
European Courts of Human Rights. So, yeah, so there are lots of other important political issues which mean that it is a tense time and the peace process is under more strain than it has been for some time. So it's not a great time to have an election. There are a couple of interesting questions, right? So there's also, as well as all this, there's boundary changes in the size of the STV constituency. So everyone is going to lose some seats anyway, which makes it slightly harder for the DUP to lose their first place. But it's not impossible, right? And there are a couple of interesting questions. Mostly in Northern Ireland, the voting is on fairly sectarian lines. But in Irisgate, and we've seen this with other sort of scandals where local councillors have resigned or whatever, there was a massive swing in Belfast East to Naomi Long, the candidate of the Alliance, who are a non-sectarian party. Their sister party is the Liberal Democrats. Massive swing. She took the seat, lost it again in 2015. But if something like that happens again, does the DUP surrender sec first place? Possibly. The True Unionist Voice, who are kind of like an ultra-ultra-unionist party, have been making a lot of hay, and they've been in the news criticising both the DUP and Sinn Féin over the scandal. Do they peel off some votes from the DUP? Arlene Foster has not covered herself in glory at all in how she has covered the scandal. I mean, I think that is the really important thing to note, that at any point the DUP would be in a stronger position now if they had just thrown their hands up and gone, do you know what, it's really not good that we had this uncapped scheme where people were literally installing boilers. I mean, just like, it is like a classic example of how if you're right wing, you can just get away with any old shit, isn't it? I mean, like, imagine if Jeremy Corbyn wanted to, like...
We definitely haven't got time to get into that argument. So let me that we can make that another, we can book ourselves for you, and are you ask us in future, which is, can, if you're on the right, get away with any old shit? You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Helen Lewis, and my co-host, Stephen Bush. It's produced by India Book, and our theme music is Devil with the Devil by the Underscore Orchestra. Why not subscribe to the New Statesman magazine? If you do, you'll get not only a column from me this week, but double Stephen Bush. He's interviewed Diane Abbott, and he's also writing the politics column. Just visit subscribe.newstatesman.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.